So we'll begin with our daily prayers on page 34 in the gold prayer book. But let's start with three prostrations first. Eyes either lightly closed or just very slightly open, but not focusing on anything. Lips lightly closed, not clenched. Tongue against the roof of our mouth. Shoulders down. And a little bit back so the chest is opened up. Upper arms away from our torso. And hands with right on left with thumbs touching, slightly below the navel. Or if you prefer, you can put one hand on each knee. And legs are in a position that you find stable and comfortable. If you're on a cushion, it helps to sit a little bit towards the front of the cushion so your pelvis is opened up. And after you've been doing this for a while, your knees will start to go down till eventually they wind up on the cushion, but don't force them if they don't want to do that. If you're sitting on a chair, your feet are flat on the floor, or if you like, you can place a cushion underneath your feet. So just scan your posture, starting from the top of your head, working down. Identify any sources of tension or discomfort now and kind of wiggle them out or work with them so they're not distracting you throughout the meditation. And we'll begin the meditation by taking three deep breaths from the abdomen. The abdomen expanding on the in-breath and contracting towards the spine on the out-breath. So the diaphragm is pulled down as we breathe in. So do three of those. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And as always, we begin our meditation by setting our motivation. And the most powerful motivation is said to be the bodhicitta motivation. The motivation that does everything for the benefit of others and wants to get enlightened so that it can become of greater benefit to others. The wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. For our family and friends, for our co-workers, towards our acquaintances, for the people that we dislike or have problems with, and all the countless strangers, become enlightened for their benefit. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation. We're doing a simple concentration meditation. The object is the physical movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils, the opening of the nostrils, the air moving in and the air moving out. We just place our concentration, our mind on that. Nothing else. Just mind on the breath. No duality, mind directly perceives breath. Not counting the breaths, not describing them, not visualizing them, but direct experience of the physical sensation, the tactile sensation of breath moving in and out. And every time we notice that our mind has wandered off, as it inevitably will, we gently bring it back to the breath, over and over and over again. And we can end our meditation by doing a brief dedication, acknowledging the positive energy that we've created, and may those imprints on our mind stream ripen in a way that benefits all sentient beings. Okay, before we do the death process meditation, which is the main event of the evening, I want to talk a little bit about some of the recommendations our teachers give us on how to help people through the dying process, if that opportunity ever arises for us. Who here has been with someone when they died? So almost more than half the people here, yeah. Anybody want to share anything about that experience? Louise, you want to say something? Did you raise your hand? Mm-hmm. Let's see, we got a mic, yeah. Okay. Yeah, remember the mics.
I've been with it in two different ways, actually. One, as a nurse, many people die, and that's been really interesting because some people die very peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
Others fight it, and the families are upset, and it's a very upsetting situation. Mm. So there's those. And then when my father died, I was with him, and it was fairly peaceful, and it was just my father, I, and my mother, so it was nice because it was controlled from not having other relatives coming in and distracting and that sort of thing. And then most recently, I mean, I volunteer with hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an interesting because everybody dies in hospice.
Yeah.
Eventually. And I've been able to...
Everybody not in hospice dies too.
Well, I know, but it's just, for me it's odd because, you know, when I have patients, you know, they go home and this is like what everybody does. But anyway, so I've been able to do some mantras with some folks and read their prayers that they want and that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Anyone else? Anything they can share before I talk about how we do it as Buddhists if we have the opportunity? Yeah, over here.
I was with my mom when she died about 15 years ago, except for the very last moment, and I think that she waited until that moment. Like, she didn't really want me to be with her then.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot in the experience, and a few years later, a woman that I was working with, her 46-year-old daughter, was dying of cancer. And for whatever reason, I knew the day that she was going to die. I knew the day that my mom was going to die. I don't know why. But I called her up. I went and sat with her at hospice. And I was actually there with the mother more so than her daughter. Her daughter was in a coma. And I knew I was supposed to be there with the mother to help her during that process.
Mm-hmm.
And we had gone to sit outside of her room. It's a nice little patio. This is in Hillsborough. And in the 20, 25 minutes that we sat out there and talked, that was when the daughter passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not really what we're talking about in this class, but it was an amazing experience, and I felt honored to be a part of that.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, yeah, up here.
I was with my mother also when she died, and I took care of her. I was living in Toledo, Ohio, and she was from Pittsburgh, but she came out and stayed with me for the last several months. But anyway, she also had cancer, but a few weeks before she died, she almost died, and the hospital called me, the doctor called me and said, please come in, your mother's dying. It was in the middle of the night. So I went in, and she went and sat with her, but she didn't die. But then the next morning when I went back in to see her, she talked to me about her near-death experience, and it really made her feel... I mean, she was ready to die anyway. She knew she was very sick, but her experience made her feel so relaxed and peaceful. Mm. And she told me, and I'll never forget this, she told me that there was this white light. Mm. And it was like a tunnel. And that's how she described it, going down into this tunnel of white light. And she said it was so peaceful. And a few weeks later, she did die. And but it was very relaxed. And it was really, again, very peaceful for her, because especially when she had that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lots of good karma in these stories to have these type deaths. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, in the back.
I was with my dad when he passed away 4 years ago, and he was in hospice and was going downhill a bit, and I flew up from Florida for it. I thought it was interesting because I was staying overnight, and we had such a big family, but I was the only one there with him, and I have a sister who's a nurse, so she gave me some heads up on the different stages that he would go through. But I tried to make it very relaxing towards the end of it, when you knew that it was kind of the final stages, and the breathing was, I guess it's chain stoking or things like that, and just tried to tell him that we've always been there for him, we're with him now, and we'll always be together. And I've kind of, up until Venerable Rabina was here, had some guilt, like maybe I wasn't the right person to be with him going through that, because I had such a big family, and he was a devout Catholic, and I really wasn't anymore. I was actually practicing Buddhist at that point, but something that she said when she was here, it was like flicking a switch. It made sense, and it was like maybe I was a good person to be with him at that stage. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah.
Robbie, I'm a retired homicide investigator, and for a period of time I was first responder. So we investigate homicides, but we also do death investigations. And as a first responder, we often responded to suicides, shootings, stabbings, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
All of those were, I was attending my mother's death, which was very peaceful, but all these others, extraordinarily violent.
Mm-hmm.
They were all terrified. Hospice is doing home care, and they had do not resuscitate orders. Like someone was teasing you about that the other night. But often the family will still dial 911, even though there's a do not resuscitate order. They're just so stressed out, so terrified that this loved one is going to die. They still call 911, and of course we have to respond. And then there's all this chaos in the home.
Yeah.
In a do not resuscitate situation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't think of a worse way to go when you know that, you know, there's nothing that can be done, and hopefully that it's going to go peacefully and comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people that are caring about you are pulling their hair out and wailing in tears and all.
Yeah.
It's a very, very disturbing thing to witness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, none of us know what the situations of our death are going to be, but that's why we need to rehearse it, practice it, so that even if it is a chaotic death, you know, not this peaceful death that we all hope we'll have, but somewhat chaotic, our mind will be able to maintain some degree of calmness. And we'll talk about that. That's really the most important thing, you know, what we can do for others, how we can help them to stay calm, and then what we can do for ourselves to prepare for that. Yeah, but there are a lot of deaths that are not like these that we've heard of.
And I've taken dying declarations where you get to a shooting call.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to ride with rescue to the hospital if they're rendering aid, and we try to determine what happened, who shot you, who stabbed you, who were you with last.
Yeah.
It's admissible, it's an exception to the hearsay rule, a dying declaration. And so you know, we're in the back of the ambulance interrogating this person, and it never occurred to me until this class what this person is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because clearly from the expression on our face, we know this is the last time this person is going to get to communicate, and we want to know what happened. I just never thought about that before this class, what that must be like.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Wendy. Wait for the mic.
I had a pulmonary embolism the end of May, and I almost died. I felt something in my heart change. I got very dizzy. I lowered myself to the floor. I took refuge, and I was gone for 6 hours. If I had died then, I would have been so disappointed. I've been practicing for the time of death my whole life, and I wasn't even there. So, and then after that, when the first responders did come, all hell broke loose, and I don't want to die like that.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking for 30, 40 years how badly we need nursing homes that cater to Buddhists, that understand how people want to be quiet and meditative, and we still don't have them, and we really need them, and I'm putting it out there.
That's your mission.
That's my Christmas wish.
Thank you. Yeah.
I had a friend 15 years ago, died of lymphoma, and I was going over to his house every night and sitting on the bed with him, and sometimes my wife would come with me, and we actually were having a good time, and he had a guitar, and one night I was sitting on the bed playing the guitar, and my wife was just sort of gently stroking his head, and he muttered under his breath, "Just like John and Yoko." And I don't know if it was that night or a couple of nights later, after being with him, I was home asleep, and the phone rang in the middle of the night. And, you know, I was assuming that it was my friend with lymphoma, but I got the news that another friend who seemed perfectly healthy died suddenly of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought of that a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about time of death is uncertain. I was so focused on this one friend and not even thinking.
Yeah, exactly.
That could happen.
Okay, thank you, everyone. As we've talked, and I think this came up in these in this discussion, but as we've talked about, what we want is at the moment of our death for our mind to be calm, undisturbed, not up and down like this. So whatever we can do if we have the privilege of helping someone through the dying process, whatever we can do to bring that about is the right thing to do. And we've talked about this dying process, and we'll do the meditation again. And if we accept the Buddhist teachings, we accept that that's something everyone goes through. Catholics, Jews, whatever their religion, according to the Buddha, this is what happens to everyone at the time you die. You don't have to, it doesn't just happen to the Buddhist, okay? The Buddhists just have gotten some teachings on what exactly happens. So we approach someone who's dying with an understanding of the death process, that it is important for the mind to separate from the body in a calm state so that it goes on to the next lifetime calm and not agitated, not excited. And the biggest danger, or the one of the things we really want to avoid, because this is so much a part of who we are, we don't want to leave this life clinging to people, things, experience, our body. Attachment, we want to minimize. We can't, most of it can't eliminate completely, but we don't want to go out with a mind that's attached to what we're inevitably leaving behind, because that creates great agitation, and that creates the cause when we get into the bardo to attach very quickly to the next lifetime without necessarily thinking or choosing, but we are so afraid of losing what we're behind, we grab on to the next lifetime, and it may not be the most auspicious one. So again, we're talking about kind of the perfect death if someone's at home in their house. If you have time, you may want to arrange the room so objects of attachment are not visible. If they're, you know, physical objects that the person says they're very attached. And of course you're doing all this with their permission. You know, you're not coming in saying, I'm a Buddhist and I'm running the show here. This is, yes. Or if this is you lying there, you know, you may, if you're attached to your books or your clothes or your shoes or even pictures of your friends or family, you may not want to have those in, at a certain point. You may say, okay, I'm letting go of these, take them out. Okay, so, but the idea is to have the room calm. If they, someone wants you to be there with them, you know, you can ask them if they'd like a, maybe a picture of Jesus if they're a Christian, or a picture of the Buddha, or one of their teachers, in a place, in a location where they can look at it frequently. Saying mantras, if the person is conscious, they can say mantras, do whatever practices they want to. If they're unconscious, it's said that there's, if you are saying mantras, as the mind goes through these different stages, it can pick up on things that normally they wouldn't hear. So you can say them out loud, or you can even say them silently. As the mind becomes more subtle, it can hear mantras that you're saying quietly to yourself. Some people actually prepare tapes that they can listen to of mantras or teachings to be played in a kind of continuous loop while you're there. You know, people may not want, at some point you may say, I don't want my friends to come in and see me anymore, I think, or I don't want to see my family anymore. I've said goodbye to them. I'm not going to cling to them. Okay? It's me alone at this point, or maybe one person in the room quietly with them. And then as we understood, as we went through the death process, when the body looks physically dead to us, the consciousness is still in the body, from the Buddhist point of view. And, if there's any way that the body, after the person appears dead by Western standards, that the body can be left undisturbed for a day would be great. It's hard to do in this day and age, but, people have made arrangements, or if you're there with them, you just don't call the ambulance as soon as they look dead. You can arrange for the body to stay there. The consciousness is still there in a meditative state, hopefully. And there's, I can't explain this. It says it's always best to touch the dead person's body on the crown of their head. That helps create the cause for the consciousness to leave through the top of the head towards possibly a more favorable rebirth. Don't touch it at the feet. Yeah, Wendy, yeah, you may know more of this than I do.
When I knew I was falling and I didn't know what was happening, I hit myself on top of the head.
When she said she hit herself on top of the head.
Because I didn't know what was happening.
Okay, yeah.
And just in case.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Louise, you asked last week about POA, and the one thing I could, transference of consciousness at the time of death, that's a practice, and the one thing that I saw about that says when the mind comes down to the clear light mind, that's when, if you've practiced this and you're a great meditator, you can shoot your consciousness into a pure land, which is, we're in the desire realm. Okay, the six realms that we talk about, gods, demigods, humans, animals, hungry ghosts, and hell beings, that's the desire realm. All of those are characterized by lots of problems, but desire, clinging, attachment is what motivates those. There are other realms, some of which are called pure lands, and if you practice this, you can bypass the bardo and the forced rebirth of samsara, and go to the pure land, which is a non-corporeal realm where incredible spiritual events are happening all the time. I don't know about that. Yeah, I'm not qualified to talk about the pure realms. Yeah.
It seems to me,
that's not something that any average person dying could be able to do.
Right.
I mean, for me, I think I would just hope to just remain calm and carry on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And where I land, okay, maybe I can sort of make the bend. But
yeah.
That just seems very, very...
That's technical. A very high practice. And they teach it openly. It's not a secret practice. You know, we've had teachings on it here from... Kirti Senshap Rinpoche, I think, taught it. You know, very high lama. You know, they're the ones who are actually going to be able to practice at the time of death, but it doesn't hurt to be introduced to it, at least the idea.
So when the Dalai Lama practices it, he's not practicing like I would, obviously.
Well, he is practicing because you still go through the death dissolution first, and then instead of coming back in the bardo, you go, so he's probably combining both practices, the death dissolution and POA, I would think. Yeah. Did I see another? Okay. Yeah. Wendy, yeah.
Tibetans usually do a POA retreat once a year.
Mm-hmm.
So they're always ready and they've always got it close in the subtle consciousness. I've requested Geshe-la several times that we could do a POA retreat once a year because we're all getting older.
Mm-hmm,
and it's
yes.
So easy. We did with Lama Yeshe in a week, and if somebody like me was successful as I was, well, everybody could be successful. I really think we need that.
Keep asking. And then after, you know, after whatever length of time that you can keep the body, the Buddhist point of view is that the body is, you can do whatever you want to with it. Okay, after the consciousness has left the body, there is nothing sacred or holy or anything about the body. You know, in Tibet, they chop it into pieces and put it out for the birds to eat. You know, you can throw it in the river. The body has no real value after the consciousness has left. It's just an old suit of clothes that can be discarded, however, is ecologically appropriate. A question here.
You say that consciousness stays in the body for a full day after death.
Well, actually, it tends to stay. It can stay there for up to 3 days, based on how good a meditator you are.
Okay, because when my loved one died, I remember immediately I saw the body and did not recognize it as the person I wanted
mm-hmm.
to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It seems it was not that soul anymore. The soul was gone. It
mm-hmm.
just a body to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. Well, the Buddhist point of view is that the consciousness, the mind, is still in the body and is still functioning, okay? Not in the way, and we'll do this as we go through the death process, not in the way it normally functions, but it becomes much more subtle, much clearer, much less personal, okay? That person,
yeah
is being discarded. Yeah, it's a very subtle... purified form of consciousness.
Moments afterwards, I didn't recognize it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Is there another hand?
This is just something that I'm wrestling with, and this is the second time I've taken this class, and I'm still wrestling with it. I'm an organ donor,
mm-hmm.
and
yes.
I recognize that. That's sort of at odds with everything that we're talking about, because if you're going to donate organs, you can't wait 1 day or 3 days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that, I don't know, there's merit generated from the standpoint of, you know, I'm doing that because I want to benefit.
I read something exactly on this. Pende Hodder, who's a Western monk in Australia, who runs a huge hospice program. They're one of the biggest hospice programs in Australia, a Buddhist hospice program. Said he had asked his teachers about that specifically, and they said that donating organs, it may agitate the consciousness a little bit, but the positive karma is so much greater than that, that they think it's valuable. If you feel comfortable with that, they say go for it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would trust his opinion on that. Okay, right here.
I have a related question. What exactly does disturbing the body before the mind is fully separated from the body, what does that what does that do? I mean, it's not going to stop the death process.
No.
So is it just like a distraction?
It's a distraction. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it tends to keep you attached to this lifetime. Okay, if you're still having any kind of bodily sensations or feelings added in, okay, it causes clinging to arise. And that's what you don't want to go into the next lifetime with, is a clinging mind. Okay.
Just a quick comment. The Rudolf Steiner, the anthroposophic hospitals mm-hmm. in Germany,
mm-hmm.
the procedure is when you die there, you are untouched for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
They have candles. The family can come and sit with mm-hmm. you. And they said that it's amazing. You can see she was just talking about the person changes. How that sometimes if they're dying in pain, everything is let go, and mm-hmm. they're just completely in bliss. How mm-hmm. the body changes over these 3 days.
Okay. So, create the call, Carl Rimmer to die in a German hospital. Yeah, great. Okay. Right here.
I don't think this question really relates to Buddhism, but are there legal implications to, you know, somebody dies at home, leaving them for a couple of days?
Of not calling, not telling anybody that you've got a dead body in your house. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 If you're not out broadcasting it, nobody's going to know when they're not. If they're dying at home, nobody will know the time of death generally, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, suicide.
Assisted leaving.
Yeah. I think in general the teachers say that, you know, actively ending your life is probably not a good thing. Okay, probably creates negative karma. But that doesn't mean that you have to accept every bit of medical treatment that's offered to you. I mean, the Tibetan lamas, you know, they get these horrible diagnoses, you know, like pancreatic cancer, and they say, I don't want any Western medical treatment. I'm going to go back to Nepal and do my practices until I die. That's not considered to create negative karma. But actually, killing yourself generally is now assisted suicide when you're in incredible pain. I'm not qualified to answer questions like that. But generally, suicide is not considered a solution to your problems because you're taking that negative karma into the next lifetime. Okay. All right. So now I want to do the death process meditation. Susie, I want to try turning down some of the lights. Can you see how? Okay. Is that going to put anyone to sleep? I think this is okay like this, yeah. And like I said last week, you are welcome to lie down on the cushions if you would find that helpful to your meditation, if that would make it more real. Just don't point your feet towards the altar, but if you want to meditate lying down and you think you can do it without falling asleep, again, you're welcome to do that. Give that a try. Because we're going to imagine that we're on our deathbed. Okay. If that makes it more real for you, the whole point is for it to be real. This is going to be a little bit longer, and I'll be guiding you through it, so you don't have to stay in strict meditation posture the whole time. But the point is not to fidget or wiggle too much, but to keep that kind of concentrated mental state that goes with meditation. If you find the meditation upsetting, or you find yourself getting scared, you don't necessarily. You can just observe that, say that's the way it is. But if you find it very upsetting, you know you can come out of meditation for a little while. Just open your eyes, touch your body, remember you're here, take your pulse. Seriously, you know, you can kind of, that's okay if it gets too much for you at any point. Okay, but no falling asleep, okay? Yeah, I'm going to walk around and hit anybody who starts kick anyone who starts snoring. Okay, so everybody, whether you're sitting in a chair, sitting on the floor, or lying on the floor, check your posture and have your hands positioned where you can hold them. And take 3 deep breaths from the abdomen. And now set your motivation, generating as much as possible the bodhicitta motivation, that even when something is personal, as rehearsing the death process, or even actually going through the death process when that happens to us, can be done with the thought that I am experiencing this so that I can be of greater benefit to others. Even the act of dying can be coupled with the bodhicitta motivation. It seems almost impossible to conceive of, but it's true. And now we'll start our meditation with a little bit of concentration, mind on the breath, physical sensation of breath moving in and out through the nostrils, nothing more than that. Every time we notice that the mind has wandered, we bring it back to the breath.
And now we'll begin our actual meditation. This is a visualization meditation. And visualization is nothing more than imagining. We're using our mind's ability to imagine that we are dying. And the more real, the more specific our imagination is, the more powerful the meditation is. So whether you're sitting in a chair or lying on the floor, we're going to imagine that you're in your bedroom, so familiar, lying on your back on your bed. And for this meditation, we're going to imagine that we're by ourselves. We've taken the clutter out of the room. It's very neat and tidy. But not a lot of stuff in there. We may have a picture of the Buddha or Jesus or one of our teachers somewhere in the room where we can glance at it when we wish to. But we know we are dying. We're not in pain, but we know that we have entered the death process. And what we experience as we go through the death process is referred to as dissolution. Dissolution of the body's ability to function, and dissolution of the gross levels of consciousness, so that ultimately all that remains is the consciousness of clear light. And that is what goes on to the next lifetime. Everything else is left behind. So there are 8 stages or cycles in this dissolution. The first 4 are primarily about the body losing its function, ability to function. And then the next 4 are about the coarser levels of mind dissolving and dissolving till we're just with the most subtle level of consciousness. And the dissolution of the body is linked to the elements of earth, water, fire, and wind. The first element to dissolve is the earth element. Our body has become very thin. Our arms and legs are limp, and we have a sense that our body is being pulled down into the earth. We have no strength left at all. And as this, we notice this, our mind loses its ability to perceive the objects around us. We no longer can conceptualize of various forms. Our vision becomes unclear and hazy. We can no longer open or close our eyes. We no longer perceive colors or shapes. All that appears to our mind's eye is said to be like mirages, swirling gray, insubstantial material.
And now the water element of our body begins to dissolve. Our saliva, sweat, urine, and blood all start to dry up. We no longer feel pleasure, pain, or indifference. Our ability to hear sounds fades away. And all that appears to our mind's eye is billowing white-gray smoke. We've lost all consciousness of what's in the room around us, of shapes, colors, forms, sounds. Our mind just perceives gray smoke. But we've practiced this. So we're prepared for this. We knew this is exactly what was going to happen. So we're not afraid. We remain very calm. And next, the fire element of the body dissolves. We lose our ability to digest. Our stomach and its content and its various enzymes are no longer functioning. We can no longer remember who was close to us, our friends and families. We've lost memory of them at this point. We can't even remember their names. And at this point, our body loses its ability to smell. There are absolutely no smells that we can appreciate. All that appears to our mind at this state is sparks or fireflies in the white-gray smoke. And now the wind element of the body begins to dissolve. inhalation and exhalation cease completely at this point. Our body cannot perform any physical movement or action. At this stage, this is what in the West we think of as death. If someone were in the room with us who didn't know these teachings, they would say we were dead at this point. Our mind has no conception of any external objects or activities. The physical world that we've lived in all our life, none of that appears to our mind any longer. That gross level of consciousness has dissolved. The tongue in our mouth is becoming thicker and shorter. And we can no longer taste anything. All tactile sensation fades away. We can't appreciate the difference between rough and smooth. If we're lying on a smooth sheet, our body is no longer aware of that. And all that our mind perceives is a flickering candle that's about to extinguish itself. So at this point, the physical body has lost all its function. But the consciousness remains connected with that body, and the dissolution process continues. As I said, this is all what we've prepared for, so none of it is frightening, none of it is upsetting. We understand what is happening, and we anticipate the appearance of the mind of clear light. But we're not there yet. But we know exactly how the process will unfold. In the next stage, we imagine that all the energy winds above the level of our heart that travel in channels to the right and left of the central channel. These thin tubes, one on either side of our spine. We can't see them, but they exist. That's where the body's energy rides up and down. We imagine all the energy above the level of the heart in those two channels moves upwards and gathers at the top of our head. And what appears to our mind's eye as this happens is empty space, completely filled with white light. The energy moves up the two channels, gathers at the top of our head, and we see brilliant white light pervading empty space. Nothing more concrete or solid than that.
And now, in the next stage, the energy below the level of the heart in the left and right channels moves downward to the base of the spine and gathers there. And what appears to our mind's eye is empty space filled with brilliant red light. So the energy moves down to the base of the spine in the right and left channels, and all that appears to our mind's eye is empty space filled with brilliant red light. And now the energy at the top of our head moves down the central channel to the level of the heart. And the energy at the base of the spine moves up the central channel to the heart. So all the energies are gathered at the heart. And all that our mind sees is empty space filled with darkness. Complete darkness. All the energies gather at the heart, and all we perceive is darkness. And now, just as we've prepared for, we experience a sense of fainting. And all the energies at our heart enter the indestructible drop that's at the center of the heart. And what appears to our mind is perfect, clear light pervading empty space. This is the most subtle consciousness, the consciousness of clear light, non-conceptual, non-dualistic. And it is this consciousness that goes forward to the next lifetime and has the potential for total wisdom, total compassion, complete enlightenment. And we've prepared for this moment, and we just stay with the mind of clear light. we just place our concentration on the clear light. Just stay with that. And you can relax your visualization now and do a brief dedication. As I said last week, that's really only half the meditation. To do the complete meditation, then you would go through everything in reverse order, with the grosser levels of consciousness arising, and then the various bodily functions coming back. That's what you would experience in the bardo, where you become this strange being that's wandering around, looking for its next rebirth. So you go down and up, and that's samsara. Any questions or comments? Yeah, let's see, okay, let's pass. Mike. Not Mike, but the Mike.
Are there any teachings on how to stay in contact with the clear light consciousness when you're going back through your rebirth? Like when you, after you reach the clear light consciousness if you can be aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Are there teachings on how to maintain awareness of it while you go through the reverse process?
I'm not aware of any. There probably are, but basically it comes from, you know, that's why we do simple concentration meditation, so we can work with something gross like our breath. So we have that ability to put the mind on the chosen object and keep it there. So that when something more important, like the clear light consciousness, when we have an experience of that, we can stay with it. So it really, it's these skills that we develop in some of the simple meditations that we would apply then, I think. Yeah. Okay, Susie.
I was outside lying down in the bookstore.
Lying down on the job.
Yeah. Trying to maintain that I'm not breathing when I'm breathing,
mm-hmm.
and that I can't feel when I can feel the floor,
mm-hmm.
and that I can see clear light when I don't know what color clear light is.
Mm-hmm.
This is something we have to develop.
Well, like I said, it's your ability to imagine. I mean, you can lie there on the cushion and imagine that you're in your bedroom, right, even though you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So then you use that same ability to imagine that you're not breathing, even though you are, and that you can't feel things, even though you can. So it's really just letting your imagination, you know, empowering your imagination. And some people are very good at it right off the bat. Some people, visualization is never easy. Some people it gets better with time. You just have to work on it.
Yeah, I just had to accept that mm-hmm. I'm breathing, but I'm not breathing.
Yeah, but like, really, your mind is, when you're thinking that, your mind is wandering too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, if you're sitting there criticizing your meditation while it's happening or critiquing it, you know, you've kind of, your mind is a little off there somewhere.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wendy. Yeah.
Okay.
There are millions of people around the world listening in.
Oh, all right. Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. My question was... I just forgot.
Sorry. Oh, it'll come back.
In developing the sense of the mind of clear light, I found that by the end of the 3 months Vajrasattva retreat,
mm-hmm.
my mind did have a very crystalline quality
mm-hmm.
that was very, very, very clear and very bright, just like crystalline sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the one and only time.
Mm-hmm.
Alas, I've lost it. So I think perhaps for developing that ability to concentrate on that mind of clear light, the Vajrasattva retreat is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if we can't do it, there are obviously obscurations that need to be purified, right? Let's see. Mike wants the mic. Mike, the mic.
Last week we talked about how you mentioned when the point arrives at which your consciousness leaves and seeks rebirth,
mm-hmm.
that you might panic and grab onto something that isn't necessarily auspicious.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But how can there be panic or any emotion if that's all been previously dissolved?
Well, the clear light, the clear light consciousness carries all our karma on it. Okay, so what we would say is that some negative karmic seeds arise when we get into the bardo. Okay, you know, it's already starting to get those grosser levels of consciousness back. So, you know, the clear light consciousness goes into the bardo. The process goes into reverse order and you have this kind of spirit existence. And that's what chooses the next rebirth or has the next rebirth forced upon it. So the grosser levels of consciousness have already started to come back.
It sounds like you're more like returning to emotion, then you're drawn to
emotion. It's called a small rebirth when that spirit body arrives, and then, you know, for whatever karmic imprints, it gets this vision of the father and mother copulating, and when the egg is fertilized, the consciousness goes, I want that. Or, you know, karma says, you're getting that, whether you want it or not, and it unites with that egg, and fertilized egg. And
your Pure Land sounded a lot more fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we got hands going up.
I've missed a couple of classes because I was away, but the spirit body, now, on average, it's 4 weeks before you take the incarnation. When does
it's in multiples of seven. 7 days. It may be after 7 days, after 14 days, after 21 days, but definitely by 49 days, okay? No longer than 49 days.
No longer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're never in the bardo more than 49 days, they say.
Well, now, when does the spirit body start forming then? Is it immediately before this?
As soon as the clear light consciousness goes into the bardo, then it starts in reverse. All this occurs in reverse order very quickly, and that's the spirit body is formed. And the spirit body wanders around in the bardo and may latch onto a new rebirth in 7 days, may die again. So you go through this process down and back up another spirit body for the next 7 days. You know, if it doesn't find a rebirth, then it dies and is reborn. So that can happen. So those are called small deaths and small rebirths. So it can happen up to seven times. So, yeah, there's a lot going on.
So these small rebirths are all of these stages again?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so you can pray.
if you're not terrified out of your gourd, yeah. Okay. You know, if you're just there freaked out, yeah, you're not practicing. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
So yeah, I feel like I can't imagine anything that I haven't experienced in some way. So when I used to live up north where it's cold and dark, I had a light box for seasonal affective disorder. So when it came time for clear light, I just imagined sitting in front of the light box. And
things like that help, yes. That's
and I know it's just a visualization, but...
I mean, trying to visualize clear light, what is clear light? I mean, what's white light? You know,
I think full-spectrum light is the closest I can come to. But I know it was just a visualization, but I found that part really pleasant. Is there value in, when it actually comes to dying, is there value in staying with that clear light?
Yes. The longer you can stay with it, and, the better. Yes, that's what these great meditators do. You know, they may die sitting up in meditation posture, and they've completely stopped breathing, and there's no pulse and no brain activity, but their consciousness is in that clear light for up to three full days, and sometimes even longer. Yeah, so they are staying in that clear light and actually practicing with the clear light mind. Okay, they're not enlightened. Okay, they're not Buddhas, because a Buddha, you know, isn't forced to go through this. But they're very great, very highly realized, and they're actually practicing with the clear light mind rather than our coarse conceptual mind that we're struggling with.
The white, I don't know if you've seen The Matrix or certain commercials where you're standing in the...
Whiter than white.
Everything's just white.
Uh-huh.
And that helps. And then also... when like a fancy new BMW is coming at me and it has those bright lights, that's pretty clear.
Oh.
The best I could do.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
What about the rainbow light body, the Padmasambhava, and some of these masters? Did you mention that?
I'm not qualified to talk about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good question for a Geshe. That's what we always say when we don't know the answer. Okay, so I think we'll...
Is there ever been a study of the Tibetan book of the Dead here?
It's not a core ask about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's not considered a important text in Tibetan Buddhism. You know, it's popularized by Westerners because it has all this psychedelic stuff in it, but the Tibetans don't think that that's a really important... They think just doing this meditation is much more important than reading the Book of the Dead. Yeah, Wendy?
There's a new translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Geshe-la Thupten Jinpa.
Mm-hmm.
I have not read it. I just saw it on
the
shelf.
So maybe it'll become more prominent. But it's not something... Yeah, you don't go to teachings on the Book of the Dead. You know, the great lamas don't give teachings on that. I'm not sure. Yeah. I think there are other things that are more important.
Is the Heart Sutra practiced here?
Yeah.
Or even the
Yeah, the Heart Sutra is a key text in the Galupa tradition.
I've never heard it chanted here.
Yeah, when I teach the DB module on emptiness,
I must have missed it.
We use the Heart Sutra as the basic text because the Heart Sutra is basically about emptiness.
Right.
Okay, I mean it's all about emptiness. Yeah, so we use that as our text.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay, well, I think we'll stop there. Thank you very much. The next module starts next week with Shankha Mitra teaching, and it is on establishing a daily practice. And then I'm not sure how many weeks go, but that starts next week. So thank you, everyone.